Hello and welcome to Theatre Voice. I'm Alex Sears and I'm in London at the Soho Theatre today with my guest, the playwright Tim Fountain, who has just written a new book called So You Want to Be a Playwright, which is published by Nick Hearn. He currently teaches creative writing at Strathclyde University, and his previous jobs include being the literary manager of the Bush Theatre between 1997 and 2001. His plays include the highly controversial Sex Addict, as well as Resident Alien, Julie Burchill is Away, and How to Lose Friends and Alienate People. He also directed the original West End version of The Puppetry of the Penis and was the main writer on the animated Channel 4 sitcom Bob and Margaret. Welcome to Theatre Voice, Tim Fountain.
Thank you for having me.
So, to kick off, could you say a bit about how this book on playwriting came about?
It's slightly ironic that given so much of this book is about telling writers to get to the end of the project, it actually began probably 6 years ago because Nick Hearn took me out to lunch when I'd just finished as literary manager of the Bush. And I can't actually remember that I proposed it to him, he proposed it to me, or we proposed to each other. But that was when the contract was signed. And inevitably, it was one of those projects that then got endlessly pushed on the back burner as I had to do another new play or another show or whatever. So it's taken quite a while to actually reach the bookshop.
Yeah, you write in the book how most of the plays that you've written, you've only managed to finish them because the deadline was approaching, or you saw your name in the brochure, or the posters had gone up. So with this one, you didn't quite have that.
There isn't the fear of imminent execution that the theatre delivers with a book, you know. I guess they could ask for their money back, and I suspect Nick probably did at one point. But it is a different thing, isn't it? When a theatre poster goes up outside the building, it's not just yourself you're responsible for. Suddenly, you're responsible for the actors and the production team and the publicity department and everything else, so you feel this huge guilt wells up inside you that this script doesn't actually exist, and you think, well, I better finish it or start it.
So what was the hardest thing about writing it, do you think?
The book? I think the hardest thing about writing the book is what the hardest thing about any form of writing. There are two hard bits. One is starting and the other is finishing. And when I say finishing, I mean completion rather than I've started and I'll stop, I've done 10 minutes. I think any writer will tell you that endless prevarication, endless avoidance of work is what you do, and then suddenly the deadline is looming and then you panic and then you hate yourself, and then sufficient self-loathing builds up that you spew the words out onto the page and somehow get to the end. So I think just, getting to the end, really. I think also there's a sense in which I've taught creative playwriting on and off for sort of 20 years, I guess now, certainly 17 years. So there was a sense in which you're summing up 17 years worth of teaching and what you've learned along the way. And in a funny way, actually, I was quite surprised that I'd distilled it down as much as I had, but I realised that I'd probably come to certain beliefs that I wanted to get across very strongly, really.
Yeah, it's powerfully written and it's very eloquent and it's very clear. You put a big stress on storytelling. Is that the essence, do you think, of playwriting?
I think it's very, very difficult to get away from storytelling. It's what we do from day one in our lives, almost. From children tell stories, it's the way we make sense of life, it's the way we entertain each other, it's the way we begin our social discourse. I think story is fundamentally important. And what I say in the book is I think far too often people get terrified of, oh, I can't tell stories, and what about the 3X structure and all of this? And while some of that is covered in the book, I say to them, go away and think about the good storytellers you know. Think about what makes a good story. Think about when you successfully tell a story in a pub and people listen, and when you tell another one and they're going, and it's because it follows a very simple thing. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. It delivers a punchline at the end. It sets up a dilemma for the character. Often the best stories are stories that we tell against ourselves. The time when I fell in love with a liar at the time when I bought a used car off somebody that didn't work. You know, those are the good stories. Nobody actually wants to hear about the great shag you had last week, because they'd far rather hear about the really bad shag you had last week. And you
know, there's something very human about that, isn't
there? Well, it's sort of squaring with the audience. I think it's one of the functions of the theatre is that we it reminds us of our shared humanity. You know, I think that's what it has in common with the church, probably, is that it we come together to realise we are all fallible.
And you also underline the fact that everybody almost has the one story that only they know how to tell, and that's where you start the book, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely believe that it's not about saying, oh, everybody's got a book in them, because you know, that old cliche, but it's because I'm not sure everybody, if they have, certainly everybody's not capable of telling it. There's no use pretending they are. But the story we're interested in as an audience is the story only you know. Now that's very hard when you're starting out, or even when you've done quite a few plays. It's very hard to think, my words, my way of seeing the world, my vision for these characters is of interest to other people, because it demands quite an act of egotism, really, and quite a lot of self-belief. And of course, the minute you lose that self-belief, what one tends to do is go for off-the-peg characterization, or to write plays about articles we've read in the Observer magazine or whatever, and suddenly this thing isn't unique. Anybody can have written it.
And it sounds like research, because it is.
Yes, because it is, absolutely. So, you know, I think I arrived at that opinion often because over the years when I was literally writing at the Bush, sometimes I'd have meetings with writers and I'd go through a script that wasn't really working or was less successful. And then we'd say, come on, we'll go to the bar and have a drink and whatever, cheer you up. And then they'd tell me these fantastic stories in the bar in a very clear voice that was very much their own. And I often would think, God, give me that instead of the play you've given me. And I came to the conclusion that often the reason they weren't doing that was that it's very hard for us to see very clearly what's closest to home. Other people can see it in us. But for us to identify in ourselves the story only we know is quite tough. And also, it demands a level of self-exposure. And I think that I read something in Diablo Cody, that US screenwriter, the other day was saying that she feels more naked as a screenwriter than she ever did as a stripper. And I always think when you hand over a script to somebody, it is like peeling off a layer of your skin, because I've just done it. I literally delivered a script today, and I have no idea whether it's any good.
No, of course not.
Yeah. If somebody comes back to me and says, this is absolutely awful, and what we're going to do, it goes on in 2 months, whatever, I'd probably go, yeah, you're right, how shall I mend it? You know, I just don't know, you never do.
And that sort of personal, actually getting to that point is actually quite hard, especially for young writers, I would imagine, because everything in society tells us to put up protective layers.
Absolutely. Absolutely, it's you've got to risk looking a fool, and you will at times.
Yeah, and also you've got to risk exposing what your imagination is like.
Yeah,
because it's no good just sort of saying, oh well, it's fiction.
Yeah,
it's fantasy.
Yeah,
it comes from you ultimately, and people will judge you.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing that cripples writers when they're starting out, I think, is are the ghosts of the writer's past. You know, so that they look and they think, I can never write a play as good as Ibsen, I can never write a play as good as Pinter. And it's something I say in the book, that, you know, for everybody out there who thinks Pinter's a theatrical genius, there'll be somebody else who actually doesn't like his obscure plays and says, what are they about? Where's the story? Blah, blah, blah. You might be the writer for them.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, don't think that just because, you know,
Someone's highly rated
and is in university libraries, you can't matter, you can.
Yeah. Another thing that you say quite near the beginning is that most common plays produced in English are those created by the singular original voice. Could you talk a bit about that?
Well, it's just I was trying to think of you know, collaborative writing in the history of the British theatre, and of course there is some, and I talk about it. But by and large, unlike the movies where four, five, six, maybe 10 writers are eventually on board, there are very few plays I can think of where we think, oh, we're bringing a new script writer the week before we open at Soho Theatre. Thank God.
Yeah.
So, you know, it is absolutely the history of the British theatre. It is by and large the history of the singular original voice, from Shakespeare through Osborne to Ravenhill through to present day. So I guess that's, you know, that's where we're at. And again, so much of what I try and get writers to do is about this belief in their own voice. It's trying to get them to release the story only they know, in the way only they know.
And do you think that that is quite difficult, because most people start off emulating other writers or imitating them even, and to find your original voice is quite a struggle?
Yeah, and I don't think there's anything wrong, and I've certainly done it, began emulating, and maybe still am, I don't know. But, you know, I think you look at, say, somebody like a poet like Philip Larkin, you know, when your Larkin began, the influence is clearly Yeats. I, for that reason, I don't particularly like the first collection of Larkin. And then, to me, the real Larkin voice emerges. So I think using, you know, using a writer, piggybacking on somebody else, and then is a way in, you know. And I think lots of writers have done it, to be honest.
To get down to more detail, you say it's difficult to learn how to write dialogue. And there's this constant debate, is it a natural facility? If you have that, is it easier to learn structure, for example, or plotting, than it is if it's the other way around?
I don't really know how you teach people to write good dialogue. You can teach people that what scenes in the theatre require are objectives, that characters only speak to get what they want. That you can teach those fundamental things, which will, to some extent, release dialogue, not necessarily good character-based dialogue. It may just release B-movie dialogue. So I think the teaching of dialogue is tough. I think you can improve your own dialogue by listening. It's something I'm very bad at. You know, I sometimes have to force myself to listen to conversations. Listen to what's being said, what people are actually trying to achieve by it. You know, does the man at the bus stop who says good morning to you every morning, is he a bore, or is he really trying to make contact with you?
Yeah, it's probably lonely.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Just dig deeper, and then you will find to the nose. But structure, I think, is something that some writers have a natural aptitude for. Somebody like Martin McDonagh seems to be very clever structure of plays. It seems to come very easy to him.
Yeah.
Beauty Queen of Lynan is a very beautifully structured play. And others have to toil over structure. You know, and for them, perhaps, just being reminded that, you know, in the first act you get your characters up a tree, in the second act you throw stones at them, in the third you get them down again, sometimes is worthwhile, you know.
What do you think, Tim, are the most common beginner's mistakes?
Not finishing. The world is full of unfinished manuscripts. The world is full of people going around going, I'm going to write a novel, I've once started a novel. And this, I encounter this across the board. And you just have to say to them, well, until you get to the end, you will not know whether the beginning is right. And, you know, I say that not in a glib way, because I find it just as difficult. I find it like pulling teeth to get to the end. But until you get there, you can't know. So that's the one big one. The other big one is the failure to send the protagonist into battle.
Mm.
Time and time again, I'd read plays at the bush, and over the years, I've probably read 4,000 or 5,000, or looked at 4,000 or 5,000 across my desk. And you'd see people create a protagonist who was trapped at the centre of the drama. They weren't able to go into action. It's fine for it to begin with a protagonist who may be trapped in a loveless marriage or lonely and seeking marriage, but then you've got to make them make the leap and decide, I'm going to pursue someone and let's see what happens, or I'm going to leave this marriage and let's see what happens. And I think it's quite hard for us as writers to push that central character into action, because in our own lives we often feel like things happen to us. That we, you know, Dad, today this happened, the bus didn't come, I couldn't get through the door, my friend stood me up, we blame everybody else. Of course, never once considering the part we played in our own downfall. Did we leave the house late or whatever, you know. So it's very important to look for what Quentin Crisp called the trouble with you. You know what your friends say, the trouble with you is, And that's the inner conflict which I talk about in the book. I talk about the three levels of conflict, the inner, the interpersonal, the extrapersonal. There may well be more than three. But I think the inner one is absolutely fundamental to me, and good plays cannot exist without the inner one, because the inner one is basically when a character becomes their own worst enemy.
Mm.
What do they do that brings about their own downfall? You look at great plays, yeah. King Lear, whatever, you know, there he is in the opening scene, Cordelia says she loves him, he can say, fine, thank you, Cordelia.
Mm.
But it's not enough for him.
Yeah.
It's a public display of affection that's not big enough.
Yeah.
So it's his own problem in his own head. Now, it's made worse by Ronald Reagan's plotting, but it ain't their fault. Mm. It's in him.
Also with that, it gives you the opportunity as a playwright to write a lot of good speeches as well for your central protagonist.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you look at Giles Bond, arguably wasn't the greatest structure of plays, but my God, could he create fantastically fucked up central characters. You know, and who were filled with self-loathing, and it gives you this incredible subtext. It gives the actors something to sink their teeth into.
Mm. And that in itself attracts good actors to want to play in the play.
Yeah,
in
you
the
can't. An actor may be attracted to a play because of its politics, but there are very few, and they'd probably be quite foolish, who would play a part that didn't really exist just because it's a good mouthpiece for a political system they believe in. I'm sure a few have done it, but you know, they don't make for good drama.
Yeah. Your play. Your book is very good on drafts as well, when to amend a draft and when not, and detail like that. From your experience of teaching, do you think you can actually teach creative writing?
I think you can make people who have some aptitude for it better. I think you make a huge difference to people who come from a background where they don't believe they could ever do it. You know, my own background was completely non-theatrical, so why the hell could I ever write plays? It made no sense. So when mentors came to me, you know, early on in my career, people like John Godber and then later on Mike Bradlin, people encouraged me. That was hugely important. They weren't teaching me about structure necessarily, they were teaching me to believe in myself. So I think you make a huge difference there. But clearly, you can't put talent where talent isn't.
Yep. And you point out also in the book that small cast plays are more likely to get produced than large cast ones. Doesn't this condemn most young writers to producing small plays?
Yeah, I mean, I think I said that, to be fair. I think probably when that was written, it was, I think things have shifted a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, I think perhaps the monsters have made a difference, but also I think theatres have woken up and there is a greater willingness to take risks and, you know, to do a project like Market Boy, say, at the National or whatever. But it would still be disingenuous to say that there isn't a greater chance of it going on with less rather than more. That's not saying you should write less characters. You should write the play you want to write. But, you know,
yeah. Well, that's especially
the reality.
When you're starting off.
Yeah.
You know, it's very different, perhaps, for David Hare or Tom Stoppard.
If you're sending a 12 character play or a 12 actor play, you need 12 actors to the bush. Now, I'm not saying that if they really loved it, they might work out a way of doing it, but it places huge financial burden on them.
Yeah.
And you're just going to be aware of that.
Yeah. And when you worked as a literary manager, could you tell within a few pages whether a play was any good or not?
Yeah. I could usually tell from the envelope. No, that's facetious. But Sarah came when she was literary manager at, I think, at Payne's Plough. You know, Sarah used to say you could just pull three pages from the centre of the script, any three pages, and you could tell, you certainly can tell whether the dialogue comes off the page.
Yeah.
You can't tell whether it's a good play, but you can probably quickly tell if it's not a very good one.
Mm.
You know, reading scripts is not actually as complicated as people make it out to be. Do you want to turn the page? Do you want to say the speech? Do you believe in this world? Do you care? It's not rocket science. You're not ticking it off going, is this a postmodern play? Is this work? None of that rubbish. What you're going is, who wants to see it? You know, I used to sit in literary managers' meetings, in script readers' meetings at the Bush, and I'd hear the reader's report, and sometimes I'd then turn to the reader and say, but would you pay a tenner to watch it? And if they couldn't hand on heart say they'd pay a tenner, I'd say, why do you expect anybody to cross London, get a babysitter first place, to come and watch this thing at the Bush? Mm. And that's not about it being commercial, it's about saying, is it vital? Is it matter enough?
Did you find it difficult to write reports on plays? Because they can be rather boring to do, because you do have to tick boxes about characters. And
I tended to get away from that, really, that my reports were quite personal, and you can't, what, character 7 out of 10, plot 4 out of 10, it's meaningless.
Yeah.
In the end, you either decide you want to do it or you don't, and then the second question is this writer worth encouraging or not? And then the third question, if it's a writer who's sent the same play 28 times, how do we get rid of them? And we had some of those.
But also it's about, if you love something, convincing a director or an artistic director or your colleagues at a theatre that it's worth backing this play.
Yeah, I mean, I was incredibly lucky, actually, because the time I was there with Mike, I can't recall a time when we did a play that I didn't want to do, or vice versa, or when I was really passionate about a play that we didn't do. Mm. Our taste was sort of, I knew where he was coming from, he knew where I was coming from, and that worked. I don't think that's always the case with the two managers.
And what happens, though, if it's a commercial disaster?
In terms of, let's say, the Bush?
Yeah, and your relationship then with the artistic director, do they blame you, or do you both
I think both Mike and I had take the rap, and sometimes you'd go, well, it was worth doing anyway. I remember we did a David Rabe play. The guy wrote Hurly Burly, very big American writer.
We
brought an American cast over. This thing cost an absolute fortune. It was playing to six people a night. And it was good.
Yeah, it was.
But nobody wanted to see it. Yeah. It was just, you just had to put your hands up and go, well, nobody fancied it.
Can you talk a bit about Resident Alien and Quentin Crisp? Because I think there's a story there, isn't there, about how you actually find a subject for a play.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose Resident Alien was my first big success, and actually, we got 5 years of touring it around the world, so it was great fun. But it began completely from Betty Bourne, who's an actor I'd known for a number of years, came to me when I'd started at the Bush and Mike and said, I'd like to do a project, and we said, Mike said, that's great, let's try and find something, and we kept going for lunch and we couldn't find anything, and then I think Mike had almost given up, and one day we had lunch and he said, I'm going back to the office, and I stayed and had the pudding with Betty. Betty always has the pudding. And he happened to mention Quentin Crisp and do a quick impression because he knew him. Not in relation to let's do a show about him. And I went, that's it, Quentin Crisp. And I came back to the office and I said to Mike, what about Quentin Crisp? He went, that's it. Just like that. And the next job was persuading Betty because he just went, why? John Hurt's done the Civil Servant, exactly. What's the point? And I said, no, imagine what we can do is the play set in Quentin's apartment in New York, this tiny, famously filthy apartment, where he always said, after the first 4 years, the dust doesn't get any worse. It's just a question of not losing your nerve. So I thought, what fun to create in this Bush theatre, this tiny little jewel box of a theatre, Quentin's apartment.
Yeah.
And to do the story, basically, of what happened to him after Naked Civil Servant, when he became a resident alien when he went to New York.
Yeah.
So, in a sense, it was a happy accident. I wrote the first draft of the script. We did a reading, and it was so long that Betty had to have a sleep in the middle. because I didn't realise just how slowly Quentin spoke. He was like this old cartwheel going around. And, so I'd written all these bloody pages. And eventually Mike actually edited some of that because I just was so close that I couldn't see it. And it opened to probably the only universally favourable set of reviews I've ever received. And then, of course, on the 10th performance, Quentin was on his way from Manchester to London. He'd flown into Britain and he was in Manchester and died. It became this bizarre scenario that everybody had said to Quentin, if you travel to England, you'll die, you're very ill, you're 90 years old, and he said, yes, but if I die in America, I'll only make page 10. And of course he managed to time his death perfectly. He said, I want to die a significant death, and he did.
There's also something about Resident Alien, there's a similarity between actor and the subject as well, wasn't
there? Yeah, I mean, I think that's why, you know, more than, oh, Quentin Crisp, what a good idea. It was more about Betty Bourne, who had, you know, been a classically trained actor, had been at Central School, who had, been in Head of the Sect with Ian McKellen in his youth, and he'd done the full Monty, and then he sort of reached a point, and I'm speaking for Betty, but I probably shouldn't, but this is as I understand it. He reached a point in his life where for him, Gay Lib had come along in the early 70s, and that mattered more than the career and everything else. And so he sort of dropped out, he moved into a drag commune in Notting Hill, he became Betty Bourne. I won't tell you his other name, because he gets annoyed. So basically, he was an actor who then had adopted a new persona. So in a sense, the veneer became the essence. And that was what, to me, Quentin had done. He turned his life into performance art.
Yeah.
And I thought, there is, you know, because Betty doesn't look like Quentin, and he wasn't as old, but on this single thing, I thought, there must be a linkage here. There are two people who became somebody else. You know, Quentin Crisp was Dennis Pratt. Quentin Crisp was an invention. It wasn't a stage name, it was an invention. An invention for life.
So that was a really happy meshing.
It was one of those incredibly happy accidents, and you know, the plane went to New York, and you know, we had a sort of fabulous time really with it for, say, 5 years.
I'd like to now talk briefly about Sex Addict. Can you tell us a bit about that show? That's one that got some fantastically ugly reviews. But, can you explain the premise, where it came from, and why you think that sort of our lovely critical establishment, including me, probably hated it?
Well, they didn't all hate it, you know. Right, I mean, Nicholas de Jong adored it. actually, to be fair, the critics were split, but people who did hate it, hated it with an absolute passion. Michael Billington thought I was more interested. I think Quentin Letts in the Daily Mail said the Daily Mail devoted the whole of page 7 to what it called curtain up on depravity and this waste of taxpayers' money. Sex Addict came about really because I was at the time was fascinated with internet sex on a personal level. One Sunday afternoon, I'd had friends round, and we'd had dinner and lunch, and then I went to show them Gaydar, which was still in its infancy, and I showed them how easy it was to get sex and how easy it was to see naked people and all of this stuff, and people were absolutely gobsmacked. And I thought, could I transfer this onto a big screen in a theatre? Could I make an experience that worked for 6 people work for 106? And could I do something that I'd long been fascinated by, which was reality theatre, which was completely take away artifice. I was going to pick up somebody on the web, the audience were going to choose who it was, we were going to chat to them live, I was going to go out and check them, the next day I was going to come in and tell the audience about it, and it became this sort of living diary. And also I was going to perform it.
Yeah.
It was a completely mad project born of one drunken evening, really, and I did a couple of tryouts at the Etcetera Theatre. It was going to the Edinburgh Fringe. And I remember the first night I came off and people had laughed. All my friends were in and people had laughed all the way through, but I thought they were laughing at me. And maybe they were a bit. But I really didn't, if they'd said. And they came off and they were all very enthusiastic. And I said, oh no, I know you're just bullshitting me. And then actually I realised that some of them weren't. They really did like it.
It's a vicarious enjoyment, isn't it? Another person's sort of ups and downs. And their sex life.
I never expected in a million years to end up at the Royal Court. I just said I had more chance of winning the lottery twice when I was taking that show to Edinburgh. But it's something that captured the public imagination. I mean, it was weird because after all these years of being a playwright and whatever, I suddenly was back to being a student carrying all my own crap up on the train to Edinburgh. And I thought, oh, what am I doing when I got on the train? I thought, this is just insanity. And then I got off at Edinburgh Waverley and suddenly there was the front page of the list and full colour was me naked and it said, this man wants to sleep with everyone in town. And of course, you know, what Edinburgh's like, everybody wants that front cover.
Yeah.
People are paying publicists huge amounts of money, they're advertising to try and get it. I didn't even have a publicist. And I thought, my God, there's a hunger for this show.
So, were some of the people you met and had sex with, were they people who actually knew that you were performing this show?
Well, Edinburgh was they didn't know at all. So, you know, the first man was a man who worked in soft furnishings at Jenner's with a huge collection of Capodimonte villagers. You know, but I mean, the show worked on the thing that really it was a mixture of the obscene and the banal. So, you know, when I did it in Camden, I remember a guy came on and he said, he wanted to have sex with me, and he said, what I want you to do is I'm going to leave the front door open. I want you to walk in, just come into the bathroom and stick it up me. So I said, fine. But then he added, he said, but my flatmate's just had a new carpet fitted, so could you take your shoes off first? And it was those gems from the heavens that the show constantly delivered. You never could. Yeah. Every single night I did it, particularly when we got to the Royal Court, I kept saying, you couldn't make it up. My friends got sick of hearing it, because reality is the ultimate outrage, as Joe Orton said. And that was partly why I wanted to do the show. Every fictionalised representation I've seen about the internet, to me, are completely faux. Because often it's you get these versions of oh, the dangers of the internet, it's this very scary place and it's just weirdos who are going on it and blah, 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 blah. And it just is nothing like that. You know, even despite the fact that I had sex with sort of 30 people at the Royal Court during the run, there wasn't one of them I thought was dangerous or a threat to anybody else. Some of them were quite strange. You know, there was a man who had 10 years of videos of himself having sex on a succession of heavily patterned bedspreads in Manor House. And there was a bisexual white witch in Chiswick who cast a love spell on me. Her girlfriend was working away at the European Parliament. So, you know, it was you couldn't make it up.
And one of the interesting things when I saw it at the Royal Court was actually watching the audience. Because some people really were quite shocked.
Yeah.
And a lot of women, I thought, you know, just couldn't believe some of the things you were saying. Did you find there was that sort of difference?
I didn't find women had a problem with it, oddly. It was heterosexual men who had a problem with it. You'd often see, I remember I walked out one night in Edinburgh and there was a front row of couples who'd obviously come because they'd read about it. And I walked out and I said, good evening, welcome to Sex Addict. This is a show where you decide who I shag, and six of them walked out. And I thought, why did you come? But often you'd see women quite enjoying it, and you'd see the husband wriggling, getting increasingly uncomfortable.
Now, why do you think that was?
I think deep down women know that men are like that, and men don't want women to know that they're like that.
Yeah.
You know, because I don't think it's just a gay thing.
You're breaking a code of silence.
I think there was, men would shag a wall if it had blue mascara on, and I don't think they want that known.
Yeah, they'd rather not admit it every single day.
Yeah.
Which brings us very nicely to Rude Britannia, your upcoming book, which will be out, I think, later this year.
June 12th.
Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, this has been a huge adventure for me. I mean, basically, it begins where Sex Addict ends. So it begins with the press reaction to Sex Addict and how it made my parents feel, as being the man who admitted to sleeping or having sex with 5,000 people, etc., etc. And it's sort of, it's billed as one man's journey around the highways and byways of British sex. And basically, what I did is I set off around the country to try and work out whether I was weirder than everybody else, they were weirder than me, whether I was just talking about it more. And also, sort of what I wanted for the next 40 years of my life, if I live that long. You know, because it's Baby Doll turns to Baby Jane if held a beat too long, and you know, my hair's thinning and greying, and you know, I'm cruising for sex at the rate I've done it may not look quite as attractive as I enter my 40s. So it's very much a sort of mixture of memoir. So there's lots of stories in the past, but it's also a sort of Bill Bryson with his pants down journey around Britain.
And so you interviewed lots of people.
Well, I did more than interviewed. I went and did things. So I joined furries, and I wore a tiger suit and went to a fursuit meeting, which is people who dress up in fursuits and spooge, which is furry speak for seamen. And they get involved in fur piles in a pub. And I went to a swingers club in Blackpool where I was thrown out for writing. I got my pen out. It's fine to stick it up somebody else's wife, but don't get your pen out. I went dogging in East Kilbride on a Monday night where I encountered a couple in a Vauxhall Astor with a Simply Red song playing. So I mean, it was sort of, it's just been, again, like Sex Addict, it's just been an incredible journey of reality, really, you know?
Yeah.
You never can make it up.
And is there enough for 20 plays now to keep you going?
I'd love to write a play about the furries. I think the whole fursuiting world is very intriguing. But
on that hairy note, I think let's bring it to an end. Thank you very much, Tim Fountain.
Thank you.